No, Tony, since we were about 12 years old, we grew up together. At the end of 78, I moved out to Las Vegas, and on his request to be to watch his back, you know, be his underboss, more or less. That's the term they use, the underboss. So that's what I was noted for, the underboss and the leader of the hole-in-the-wall gang.
So when they take the silver dollar, they got to go around different banks.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Welcome to the classic old Ice House building in Midtown Kansas City, all you wiretappers out there. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Last week, we set the scene in Las Vegas in 1978, 79, 80. The National Mob Commission had met and agreed that the Eastern families, the Eastern La Cosa Nostra families, would dominate and control illegal activities in Atlantic City. And Chicago and the Midwest families, the three Midwestern families, would control Las Vegas, primarily Chicago. Now, the Chicago outfit in Cleveland, Milwaukee, and Kansas City all had a Teamsters Union pension fund guy who they could control. Kansas City had Roy Williams, Milwaukee had a guy named Frank Rainey. Cleveland had Jackie Presser, and Chicago had Alan Dorfman. Those four men manipulated the Teamsters Union Pension Fund to loan $62 million to a man named Alan Glick to buy four casinos, the Stardust, the Hacienda, the Fremont, and the Marina. The Stardust, of course, would be the flagship. Frank Ballesteri, the boss of the Milwaukee family, would order Alan Glick to promote a current Stardust employee named Frank Lefty Rosenthal to a position of authority in his corporation. In 1971, the Chicago outfit had already ordered Lefty Rosenthal, who was a professional gambler living down in Florida at the time, to move to Las Vegas and begin an infiltration of the gaming industry. Later in 1971, the Chicago outfit boss Joey Iuppa ordered Tony Spilotro to move to Las Vegas in support of their interest. He replaced an aging Chicago outfit member named Marshall Caifano, who had been Chicago's man in Las Vegas and Chicago's man all in the southwest part of the United States. Spilotro would open a gift shop in Circus Circus under his often-used alias, Anthony Stewart. I think Stewart was his wife Nancy's maiden name. The Circus Circus owner was Jay Sarno, and he had received a $43 million Teamsters loan to get that casino, so he couldn't really question the new gift shop owner. Tony Spilotro would eventually be found out by the Nevada Gaming Control Board and placed in the Black Book of Banned Persons. An interesting little sidelight, Aaron. Tony Spilotro invested $70,000 in this gift shop, and he would sell it for over $700,000. That's a pretty good return on your money, I would say. $630,000 in just a couple, 3 years' time.
They probably had some great sales, you know. They had a source to great jewelry and merchandise.
Yeah, really.
At a discount that was incredible.
I got a feeling that was some other kind of a kickback from Mr. Sarno. I don't know. After the Nevada Gaming Commission found out who he was and put him in the black book, he couldn't go in the casinos anymore, and he had to use other people to pass messages back and forth between himself and Lefty. They needed to avoid any overt contact because the FBI and Metro Police Intelligence and Gaming Control were watching them closely by the later 70s. Frank Culotta was not particularly known to Vegas authorities or to the local intelligence or the FBI, and he tells a little about his access to the four outfit-controlled casinos because of his connection to Tony Spilotro.
Tony Spilotro couldn't even go into his own gift shop.
No, he had to sell it. He opened another place, but no, he had to sell it out because he couldn't go in the casino anymore. Isn't that weird? He can't even go into the coffee shop and eat. They tried to set him up once, and he set up Gaming Control. His brother went in,
He looked so much like him.
And it looked a little bit like him, and then they got somebody else to go rat him out, and then they made a big production of rushing in there to, you know, get the casino and get Tony Spilotro, and it wasn't him, it was his brother.
Michael.
Michael, yeah, I think that Michael or Vincent. He had two brothers, but it should have been Michael because he was the one that was a criminal and out there. But he was not the kind of criminal that people knew. If you remember Michael, a little interesting sidelight on him, Michael was an actor, and he was on Magnum P.I. He had, a regular part on the show about the Baba Black Sheep, about Pappy Boynton and the World War II.
Black Sheep Squadron?
Black Sheep Squadron, yeah. He had a regular part
on
that.
One of my favorite TV shows.
You like that? It was a pretty good show. Play that part of that interview from Frank about his activities in and around the casinos.
But then with the casinos, we could do anything we wanted, and, you know, like I said, shows and, you know, getting people jobs in the casinos. But, you know, we just didn't put anybody to work in the casinos. We put, like, people that were related to people. Everything was favors. You know what I mean? One favor, you get another favor. You know what I mean? That's what it was all about. The cash rolled through the skim. I didn't get none of that.
So Frank wasn't really involved with the skim, but he was able to go in and out of the casinos and get favors from the casino operators. You know, if you knew Tony and you were coming out to Las Vegas and you need tickets to a show, why, he'd be able to get you good tickets to the show just with a simple phone call to the concierge or some other connection he had there in the Stardust. And that's the way Las Vegas used to be. That's some of the things that people bemoan about today, and that's all owned by
corporations.
Yeah. You can't, it's hard to make those personal connections where you can get that little extra, special treatment in a casino.
Well, and here's Frank coming out to cover Tony's back, and he's like, he's got to still get a job, essentially.
Yeah, well, and in the outfit, Tony doesn't pay a regular salary. Frank did not work for the outfit, you know, for like, $2,500 a month and health insurance and a pension guaranteed.
401k.
401k,
they're,
yeah,
trying to match it.
Well, during this time, Tony Spilotro needed to make money, too. I mean, he didn't get a salary working for the outfit either. But one thing he knows how to do big-time scores, because as we talked last week, we talked a lot about some of the early scores that Frank and Tony Spilotro did together. If you remember, they did that one bank job together, and Frank netted $50,000 just for his end, and that was after paying a street tax to the outfit and after the other guys got their cut, and Tony Spilotro was part of that. He knew how to do jewelry stores, banks, purse stores, rob drug dealers. He knew how to do that. He opened a jewelry store after he got kicked out of the Circus Circus. The name of it was the Gold Rush Limited. They used that as his headquarters and a front to fence stolen goods. It was like a, you know, kind of like a pawn shop. They'd have jewelry, but...
Still there?
No, it's not.
What's the address?
The address is, it's just off the strip. It's 228 West Sahara, and it's a vacant lot now. Well, by this time in his life, Tony Spilotro is what you would call the organized crime boss of Las Vegas. And a boss does not go out on scores, of course. He just sits back and rakes in the money and helps set up the scores and puts people together. Things like that. Spilotro answers to Chicago through Joey, or Lumpy, Joey the Clown Lombardo, Joe Lombardo. Spilotro recruited Frank Culotta, who will help recruit other Chicago burglars to join his crew. What Tony wanted to do was, with Frank, was have him ramrod or underboss or boss a crew of really good burglars. And between Spilotro and Culotta, they put together guys who will eventually be called the Hole-in-the-Wall Gang. Now, it's like law enforcement and the press gave them that name because they'd always break in through the walls rather than kick in a door or something of these businesses that they would burglarize, jewelry stores and fur shops and banks and things like that.
But these guys were all professional criminals.
Oh, yeah. They were all good burglars, mainly is what their expertise was, burglars, although a couple of them were stone killers, as we'll learn as we go through this show today.
And snitches.
Well, and in the end, a couple of them were, actually. Frank ends up, of course, as we all know, but there's somebody in between there that helped make Frank into a snitch. Well, all that's for episode 3, actually. That's just a little teaser about episode 3. Stick around for next episode to find out who the snitch was. Now, Aaron, I found a great interview of one of the hole-in-the-wall burglars named Ernie DeVino, and he was part of the gang from its inception. Unlike the others, Ernie DeVino was not from Chicago. He was from New Jersey. He was a New Jersey mobster who had migrated to Las Vegas on his own.
My father was a boxer, and he came home from the war. He was approached by men who introduced him to the boss of the area around Hoboken at the time, Albert Anastasia. He was told that my father could knock out a guy with one punch, and I think Anastasia was very interested in that. We never wanted for anything. I had everything I wanted except him. He was never home. I was very envious of the other kids whose fathers were around at their school functions and the like.
Now, Aaron, kind of an interesting thing about Ernie DeVino and Frank Culotta, I think they both kind of wanted to be the alpha male of the gang. Of course, Frank's connection to Tony Splatro gave him the upper hand. But play this little clip what Ernie DeVino said about starting the hole-in-the-wall gang.
The original, what you would call the hole-in-the-wall gang, was started by Leo Guardino and myself. We started out together before Frank Culotta came. Leo Guardino and I were tearing things up. When Frank came along, we were already doing things in Las Vegas. When we got hooked up with Tony Spilotro, things got a lot better. People were throwing money at me.
So Ernie DeVino likes to think that he actually started the hole-in-the-wall gang. I got a feeling that history will always look at this as Frank Culotta and Tony Splatro's gang, no matter who actually started. I would imagine he was out doing burglaries with this Leo Guardino, and Frank Culotta recruited them into the gang because they were well-known good burglars and trustworthy guys within the mob world. And then it kind of like morphed on into a bigger gang, and of course they never got the publicity that Frank Culotta and Tony Splatro got.
But they still got enough publicity. But these guys were there doing it. They were working the street when Tony comes along.
Right.
Of course, now he's really the boss of Vegas. So what are they going to? They're going to have to come in underneath him.
They pretty much have to. Yeah, you know, that's kind of how it works. Either that or they got to really lay low and maybe not do any really big scores in Las Vegas and let Tony Splatro and Frank Culotta find out who they were. Especially if they're like mob guys. And Leo Guardino was a mob guy, a lifelong mob guy from Chicago, and DeVino was from New Jersey. So, you know, if you're already a known mob guy and you start doing scores and you're in another mob guy's territory, you're going to have to kick him some money. It's a franchise operation. It was definite territories. Noted author Denny Griffin, who wrote probably the definitive book about this time in Las Vegas, titled The Battle for Las Vegas, and he also wrote several other books on Frank Culotta, he wrote one on Andrew DiDonato, who has been on the show. Denny Griffin knows his way around these gangsters.
Frank put a crew together. They came to be known as the Hole in the Wall Gang, dubbed by the police, as a matter of fact, because what they did back at the time, there weren't a lot of motion detectors for burglar alarms. It was window and door alarms. So what they would do, they'd cut a hole in the wall, sometimes the roof of the business they were going to enter, and that's how they'd get in and bypass the alarms.
So one of the first burglars that Frank recruited himself was a man named Wayne Metecky, who was from Chicago. I think Wayne Metecky actually always kept a residence in Chicago and would come out periodically just to do a score. He was a pretty good candidate for that reason, because he was totally unknown to local cops. And actually, he didn't have any criminal record. He'd never really been caught of anything where he got a conviction and people started paying attention to him. So anytime Frank had lined up a score, Wayne Metecky would fly into town and then leave immediately from an airport out in California or down in Arizona. Now, Frank tells a story about testing Metecky early on.
He came out there to visit, and he said, "What do we got here we can rob?" And I start laughing. I said, "You want to do a Sears?" I said, "They got a bunch of furs in there." And he says, "Yeah, let's do it." So we got a hold of this Anthony DeLillo. That was Mike Swadek's nephew, and he lived in Las Vegas. I put this crew together real quick, and we went over to the Sears on off of Maryland Parkway. And Wayne went in there and hid in there, and when it was time to come out, he brought the bags out, loaded up all the furs in there. And I was in the second car, and Anthony was in the car that was to crash the window. He rolled up to the window, Wayne crashed out, they loaded the furs in the car, and we took off. It wound up being a shit score, but it paid for his trip, you know, out there. So, like I said, us guys didn't like to spend our own money. We liked everything free.
You know, and if you remember, Wayne Metecky also went along with Frank Culotta on the Jerry Lisner hit. So Frank knew that Metecky had the heart to do these jobs, and he became an integral part of the team or the hole-in-the-wall gang.
Metecky brought the extra bullets in, probably, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He was the one sitting down in the car and brought in the extra bullets.
Frank ran out of rounds, and they needed some more. Metecky, listening in on the police scanner, brought some more bullets in so Frank could finish the job.
I think maybe Metecky was not like a career burglar, and you know, a lot of career burglars will figure out locks and alarms and ways to get into stores and things like that. He was the kind of guy that would do what Frank told him to do, and he really had the heart to do anything, whether it was kill somebody or just stay inside of a store while it was closed and then put all the property together and then break out whenever
they drove the car through the front window.
Yeah, you could do that too. Sometimes they just kick out the front door and back up the car to it. But
now
that's one way of doing things, just ram a car right through the plate glass window. Leo Gardino, I couldn't find out much about him, Aaron, other than Leo Gardino was a Chicago burglar. And one thing I did learn at this point in life, he was getting older, and he said he was tired, and he was trying to go legit, but after a lifetime of being in and out of jail, he was really struggling figuring out how to earn a legitimate living. And as we learned from Ernie DeVino, he was back to making scores.
Leo Gardino was the most loyal guy you ever wanted to meet, but he got mixed up with Frank Culotta and Tony Spilotro, and they took advantage of him.
Frank Culotta would later describe Leo Gardino as a Chicago career criminal who was trying to go legit when he joined the Hole in the Wall gang. I got a feeling, you know, we started this series off talking about the last big score. He might have thought this would be his last big score because it was supposed to be over $1 million score. And I got a feeling that Leo Gardino, I'm kind of speculating here, what do you think, Aaron, that he this might be his last big score and he could retire from life?
Yeah, maybe that was legit in his line of business.
That was legit. Yeah.
That was going legit. You know, it's like a JFK hijack.
A JFK hijack.
You know, where they went into the, or was it LaGuardia where they went in?
LaGuardia, yeah.
They went in and they got all that.
Yeah, that was going to be their last big score. For most of them, it was their last big score because Jimmy the Gent Burke killed all of them except Henry Hill, and Henry Hill wasn't even in on the score. In the last episode, we talked a little bit about a Las Vegas Metro cop named Joe Blasco, and he had been caught giving information to Tony Spilotro. We learned that the new chief of police or the new sheriff of the combined Las Vegas Metro Clark County Sheriff's Office, John McCarthy, had cleaned out the intelligence unit and installed an incorruptible commander named Kent Clifford. Now, by the time the Hole-in-the-Wall gang was going big time, Blasco had been fired from Las Vegas Metro. He's working as a bartender and helping Spilotro out with, you know, like giving a technical advisor on police activities, helping him do his counter surveillance. Spilotro was big on trying to have scanners and see if the cops were watching him or following him around or what they were doing. Tony Spilotro told Frank Culotta he needed to use Blasco on the scores so Blasco could actually make some money. Culotta was not real crazy about this, but he did. I believe Joe Blasco was a pretty big guy. Tony Spilotro always called him the big guy. So Ernie DeVino at least had a little bit of something to say on Joe Blasco. Frank Culotta had nothing to say about Joe Blasco other than when they were talking about killing him later on.
Joe Blasco was a corrupt cop. He was a big, tough guy, and I never minded that he used to be a cop. Las Vegas Metro did not take bribes, and at that time was a great department. They were hard on us. They followed us everywhere.
By this point in time, Las Vegas Metro, they'd gotten rid of Joe Blasco, and Kent Clifford had come in and gotten rid of several other guys, which we talked about last week. And their reputation is they're a good department and they're not corrupt. It seems that you can clean up a corrupt police department. It must not have got so corrupt that it was systemic like it was for a long time in Chicago or in New York City. One of the most unusual members of the Hole in the Wall gang was a guy named Larry Newman. Now, we've talked about Larry Newman before. You remember him, Aaron, when Paul Scharf was on here?
Yes.
He's the guy that killed Paul's dad and the bartender. When Frank first met Larry Newman, he was serving time for a triple murder. It seems that in 1956, Larry Newman became angry at a Chicago bartender. He left and returned with a shotgun and killed a bartender, a waitress, and a newsboy who just happened to stumble in the tavern at that time. This guy was bad, man. He had served 11 years of a life sentence when he first met Frank Culotta.
I met Larry Newman at Stateville Penitentiary. He was doing 125 years for a triple murder. We both worked in the same department together. We worked for, in a hospital ward for the criminally insane. Strange guy. He was a Jewish lad. He had his IQ was 169. He was a very, very bright man, but he was a very, very dangerous individual.
He did not grow up with other gang members, which is usually a pretty good prerequisite to get into an outfit-connected gang. But if he met one of them in prison and they spent time in prison with him, then he would be accepted and brought in if he was seemed like he would be of some use. And Frank Culotta knew that Larry Newman could be of some use. I think Frank even told us that even Tony Splottro was a little bit scared of Larry Newman. Larry Newman was a child of a wealthy Chicago family, and he had enough monthly income from a trust fund that he didn't really have to work. He's merely elected to be a criminal, if you can believe that. Aaron, would you go be a criminal if you had way more than enough money coming in every month from a trust fund? Just be a criminal for fun as your hobby?
No, not really. I mean, because, you know, odds are you're going to get caught, no matter how smart you are. I mean,
really?
Maybe my IQ is only 140. His was 160. He's serving 3 life sentences. I want to know how they got him out.
I got a feeling that money talks and bullshit walks in the Cook County court system, and I got a feeling that he got some kind of an appeal.
And they threw it out.
And he ended up getting the original charge thrown out or getting his sentence commuted. He could have even gotten commuted through the governor. There's a lot of funny things can go on in Illinois state government as well as Cook County court system.
Larry Newman was quite a fellow. Larry Newman had absolutely no reason to be a criminal whatsoever. Larry Newman had inherited a fortune off his father, who was in the sporting goods business. He got it quarterly because his father would not give it to him in one lump sum because he knew he'd blow it.
Sounds like my father. If I had a trust fund.
Sounds like what I'll do to my kids. No, not really. I don't have enough money to set up a trust fund for them. During these years, when the Hole in the Wall gang was operating, Larry Newman continued his murderous ways. If you remember the Paul Scharf interview, and I've got a little clip from that.
Maybe he was mad that he was only getting paid every quarter.
He'd blow it all in drugs and alcohol and strip clubs and things like that. And
after
so he needed to make
to
money
crime.
In between. During this time, Larry Newman became angry at another bartender. He seems to like to go out. Don't piss off Larry Newman if you're the bartender. A man named Ron Scharf ran a joint in suburban Chicago up in McHenry County, which is, I think, the next county north west of Cook County, and he ejected Newman's former girlfriend. Newman was out in Las Vegas, and she called him and mentioned the incident and kind of complained about this guy, threw her out of the joint. And Newman became enraged, and he talked about going back and killing this guy. Frank Culotta Paul told us that Frank Culotta learned about this threat, and he told Newman just to forget about this. This is not important. We don't need the heat, so don't do it. But Larry Newman, being Larry Newman, felt like he was entitled to take some kind of revenge, so he flew back to Chicago. Went up to the joint, found Ron Scharf and his waitress just getting off of work, went in and killed them both. I think, if I remember right, Paul said that they were found just sitting on a couch in the office. We were kind of speculating, if you remember, Aaron, we're speculating that probably Larry Newman brought him back there at gunpoint and sat him down, and they thought they could talk to him and maybe reason with him, because Ron Scharf would have known Larry Newman. Larry Newman had been in and out of that joint and hung out in that particular area of Lake County, or I mean McHenry County.
He might have kicked out his ex-wife before.
Yeah, really.
She probably called him, you know, and said, you got to do something about this guy. Why couldn't he just said, hey, listen, you're going to have to let her come back in?
Yeah, really. Well, I think he probably tried to reason with him, but the Larry Newman being Larry Newman, he killed them both.
We talked with Paul Scharf about this. He wrote it in his book, Murder in McHenry.
Right. Look up there. We have a 3-episode series on this. Pretty interesting book and interview written by the son of Ron Scharf and how he found out that Larry Newman was the actual murderer of his father years and years later. And if you remember, he found it out because of the book that Denny Griffin wrote with Frank Culotta. They had told the McHenry County Sheriff's Office, but they just didn't do anything. A friend of Paul's babysitter or something, was reading that book and realized that they were talking about Paul's father's murder, who then told her dad, who then called Paul and asked if he knew anything about this book. So Paul ran out and bought it immediately, and the rest is history.
Wasn't it in the book that they basically, like, that Frank was saying that that Larry Newman was telling him, I'm flying back to Chicago, and then he left. He flew back to Chicago, then he comes back to Vegas afterwards.
Yeah.
And I think at that point that he had admitted maybe to Frank that he killed him.
I think he did. Frank said, oh, you don't.
Kind of recollect that.
I think so. Because I think Frank said, you know, don't tell me that shit. I don't want to know about that. And they just held their breath. And of course, he did get away with it for a long time. The only reason it was ever found out because Frank told the cops about it years later. Go ahead and play that clip of, I got snagged a little bit of our interview with Paul Scharf talking about Larry Newman.
And keep in mind, Larry Newman didn't do any of this because he had to. This because he loved this stuff. He loved hurting people. He loved killing people.
Well, Frank mentioned that Larry Newman was a dangerous individual. So did Ernie DeVino, I think, if not in the clips that we have. Certainly in other parts of his interview, Paul Scharf talked about him. He was a dangerous individual. Just to demonstrate exactly how dangerous Larry Newman was, Frank set up a score on a Chicago jewelry store owner named Bob Brown. He put Wayne Metecky and Larry Newman together and gave them the description and the address of Bob Brown's store. They flew back to Chicago. Actually, Larry Newman flew back. Wayne Metecky was already there. Frank had told him there'd probably be as much as $100,000 in jewelry in the store, and they could bring it back out and fence it through the gold rush. But Frank also warned him that this guy was connected to Alan Dorfman, who was the outfits man inside the Teamsters Union, and they had to keep quiet about this job. So he was not telling Spilotro before the job and would not tell him where the jewelry came from if they brought it out and fenced it through Tony. They may have had to fence it somewhere else, actually, now that I'm thinking about it. Dorfman was really close to Joey Lombardo. Joey Lombardo, during this point in time, Aaron, would spend almost every day at Alan Dorfman's office, just hanging out there and talking. There's a lot of wiretap footage and microphone audio of Joey Lombardo just shooting the breeze with Alan Dorfman.
The job's in Chicago.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of their home turf to go rob a jewelry store.
Frank took a heck of a chance here, actually. He must have decided it was worth the chance.
$100,000.
He must have decided it was worth the chance, because if Lombardo had then gone to Spilotro, and Spilotro would have gone to Culotta, and they would have said, oh, no, I don't know anything about it. It wasn't any of my guys, wasn't any of our guys. And then it came out that's who it was. Larry Newman wanted to make sure that there was nobody that could tell on him that he was part of this robbery.
It was just like Frank said, but the guy came in on us, and I was afraid he might recognize me. Frank had told me the guy was connected, and I knew it was a dead man if this came out. He had some daggers and stuff on the wall, so I grabbed one and I stuck him. Then I took coat hanger and I choked him out. Then I thought I would make it look like a lunatic had done this. So I grabbed a machete from the wall and I hacked him up. And the cops think a nutcase did this.
A nutcase did do it. Not gonna like... Sorry, Larry, you're not gonna make the cops think somebody else that's a known serial killer that just works for the mob. You're not really a serial killer, I guess, if you work for the mob. But
then it's okay.
Yeah, he stabs the guy, then he got a coat hanger to choke him out.
Yeah, and then hacks him up with a machete, so he'd think a nutcase did this.
Now, but Frank didn't... Did Frank intend to have Larry kill the guy?
No, he did not. He was madder than hell.
Like that would cause more problems.
He said, what did you do that for? Why did you kill him? Well, you know, I didn't want the guy to identify me. I was afraid he'd identify me. So by this point in time, Frank's main crew were the three men he knew from Chicago, Larry Newman, Wayne Metecky, and Leo Gardino, the ex-cop Joey Blasco from Las Vegas, and then Ernie DeVino from New Jersey. Tony Spilotro particularly liked Blasco because he had fed him a lot of information while he was still a cop and continued to advise him on, you know, situations that would involve cops. He probably had a connection back into the police department to get license plates checked and get backgrounds run on people. Leo Gardino, if they were unsure about Ernie DeVino, but they were probably, it would have been sure about Leo Gardino because he was a longtime Chicago guy, he could have vouched for Ernie DeVino. Those two guys specialized in burglaries, Larry Newman and Wayne Metecky, they were capable of anything from armed robbery to murder. Joey Blasco could help in counter-surveillance and use his cop connections to get information. So this really rounded out the team. They had some other people that came and went in and out of the team, and one of those was a guy named Sal Romano. He was a longtime Chicago burglar, knew a lot about alarms and lockpicking and getting into places. And he'll complete the hole-in-the-wall gang members who end up at Bertha's Gifts and Furnishings. Ernie DeVino actually got to know Sal Romano, Frank wasn't inviting Sal in on the Bertha's job, but Ernie DeVito invited him in on it because he thought that the guy was such an expert in locks and alarms, they probably need him.
And it was his crew anyway.
Ernie DeVino's crew?
Ernie
thought it was his crew. He wanted it to be his crew.
Meanwhile, Wayne Metecky can stand by while Larry Newman just stabs and chokes out and hacks up a guy.
I don't think you'd want to get in between Larry Newman and somebody he wanted to kill, do you? He was a great big guy, too. He was about 6'2" or 6'3" and about 250 pounds, and he wasn't fat either.
No.
Play that clip on Frank talking about Sal Romano.
The only problem is one of my guys on my crew decided to do it on his own. He filled in this guy by the name of Sal Romano. And I didn't like Sal Romano because I had a terrible gut feeling about this guy not being a good guy.
So Frank didn't really like him, had kind of a gut reaction to him, but Tony Spilotro said, don't worry about it. Let's take him on. We need him. Now there's kind of a story that about Sal Romano doing a burglary set up by outfit member Paul Shiro, who was living down in Phoenix at the time. Shiro had different friends and connections in the country club down there and kind of lived a different life, not really a life of a mobster. And when he was in Phoenix, people didn't know him as a mobster. And he knew about a rich guy who supposedly had a pretty decent amount of jewelry and cash in a safe inside his house. And he was able to tell Romano and a small crew when that guy was going to be gone. So they went down into Las Vegas, and Romano defeated the alarm. They made their entry, and right after they got in, a small dog came rushing in there and started barking and raising a ruckus. Romano just backed out and told the crew, you know, come on, we're out of here. So when he goes back to face Paul Shiro and tell him what happened, Shiro says, well, why don't you just kill a dog? And Romano said, I don't do dogs. What about you, Aaron? Would you do a dog? funny how they these distinctions some of these mobsters will make.
Yeah, I would kill a person, but I'm not killing a dog. Maybe yeah. Just muzzle the thing.
Really?
How about that?
It was a strange deal.
Like everyone's, we're backing out. We're gonna get. We're not doing the score, and I'm gonna have to go tell the guy who might kill me.
But anyhow,
that I didn't do it because there was a dog barking.
Really, Ernie DeVino liked this guy.
I remember that guy, Sal Romano. He was from Chicago. I never knew him very well, but Tony liked him, and that was good enough for me.
No, Tony liked him. Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. So Sal didn't really know him that well, but Tony liked him.
Tony didn't kill dogs either.
He just killed people. We'll hear a lot more about our friend Sal Romano the next episode. But first, let's talk about a particularly unique situation that happened during this time with Las Vegas Metro PD. Aaron, this is an event so strange that it almost defies explanation. How could... I was involved in a lot of surveillances and a lot of stuff, but what happened to these guys was I just couldn't believe it. During these years, Frank opened a pizza place, and he claims that he was the first person to introduce Chicago deep dish style pizza in Las Vegas. Frank introduced this deep dish style pizza at the Upper Crust Pizza Place, and then he also bought a lounge right next door called My Place. These were located at 4110 South Maryland Parkway.
Sounds like another great address for your Kansas City Mob Tour app.
Yeah.
Even though it's not in Kansas City.
Even though it's not in Kansas City, and there's really nothing there now except it's called the Pioneer Plaza. Those of you guys who go out to Las Vegas and want to check out 4110 South Maryland Parkway, it's a small strip mall. There's one kind of funny story about this joint. Culotta found a camera and a microphone that the FBI had hidden in the ceiling of his place. So he gave them to Oscar Goodman, and Oscar Goodman made the feds produce a letter certifying that they had court authorization to install these devices. You know, most of you mob fans, if you go on Facebook, or especially if you see anything about the Las Vegas crime scene, you've seen that famous picture of Frank and most of these guys sitting in the sidewalk table in front of his joint. They kind of look like Tony Soprano and his crew out in front of the meat market.
You mean with their hands over their mouths?
No, they didn't have their hands. They were just like gawking up. It looked like they were almost posing. They were looking right at the camera. That was the one where the cops tried to put some cameras in the bank across the street and got ratted out.
By one of the bank employees.
Yeah.
We were comped for everything we wanted at the Stardust. Frank Culotta, when he got married in the Stardust. The Upper Crust is where we hung out, where all the schemers came to give us tips on where the money, jewelry, or the drugs was, and then they came back and got their cut after the job. The bar next door was my place, Tony Spilotro's favorite bar. We all felt safe there. This was our joint.
That's kind of interesting that they felt safe there. Because that's where they hung out, and I could see that. Tend to relax where they feel safe, although they didn't relax too much because they were obviously searching around, checking for any hidden microphones and cameras and all that.
Well, once they found the first set, that doesn't mean that another set doesn't exist.
That's true. That's like people put up real cameras and a fake camera right next to it. If you remember that arson down at the Herford House where your friends got popped in that arson... At the Herford House,
down 18th and Main. House. You say my friends.
Your friend. Yeah, they're your friends.
They're my friends. They're people that happen to be customers at Chubby's on Broadway late at night.
But you were their friend. You talked to them.
Well, I would wait on them.
You tried to get them to let me interview them.
Yeah. And
I said no.
That went nowhere. I think the guy said.
If you remember.
I think the quote was, oh, he wants a snitch.
They took out the fake camera and left the real camera there so they had good pictures of him.
It would have been funny if Oscar Goodman would have been given like a fake microphone.
I may have told this story before, Aaron. If I did, stop me. Willie Camisano.
I've heard it.
No. Have you heard it?
No.
Willie, I hate to tell the same story over
no,
and over
No, I don't know
again.
If I've heard it. You just started that way. And
okay.
I'm like,
all right. All right.
Like I am.
All right.
No, go ahead.
So Willie Camisano had a place where he hung out. That's where they killed David Bonadonna. 535 Monroe was it was like a garage, and he just kind of hung out around there.
Is that in your app?
I think so, but I can't remember. I haven't looked at the app for a while. the guys would walk out in front to talk, and they'd walk up the street and stand around this post and talk there. And there was a bunch of trash and stuff laying around the post, so the FBI put a wireless microphone down in that trash. And like the next time that they walked up and were standing around there, a guy who was an informant for the Bureau anyhow, looked down and he said, "Well, what's that?" And they start kicking around at the stuff, and they exposed the microphone and the little sending unit. So they took it out, of course, and then took it to one of their lawyers, just like these guys like Frank did here, took it to Oscar Goodman. They took it to one of the mob lawyer, Byron Fox, who then took it back to the FBI and actually took it back to a judge down there that had tried a bunch of the mob cases and gave it to that judge. And then the judge turned around and gave it to the FBI.
But did you have to have a warrant or something from the judge to say you could put a microphone in the trash on the street?
Oh, yeah. Down any kind street? Of audio surveillance, you got to have a warrant. You cannot do it. You can do a video surveillance without audio without a warrant, but you can't do audio surveillance without a warrant.
They didn't have cell phones back then. So we could just record everything.
Yeah, really. This was early in the cell phone. There wasn't many of them around.
Yeah, having a wireless mic was probably a big thing.
Yeah, it was. It was huge to have one good enough that you could, pick up the audio from it. It probably wouldn't have worked very good, but it was kind of a let's try it. One of those deals, let's try this and see if it works. So we digress. I mentioned before there's a story that like defies explanation that happened out of the upper crust. It was a tragic story in a way, tragic at least for somebody. Started at this same sidewalk table I talked about, the upper crust. You might title this story, "The Night the Cops Killed Frankie Blue." That would make a good title for noir books. One of those those B movies with,
could call it "The Night Frankie Went Blue."
I know, "The Night They Killed Frankie Blue." Yeah, "The Night Frankie Went Blue." That is a good one, Aaron. Frank Bluestein, or Frankie Blue, was a young guy whose father, Charles Bluestein, was an outfit associate, and he was involved with the Culinary Workers Union in Las Vegas. Frankie Blue had moved out to Las Vegas, and they'd got him a job working as a maitre d' in the Hacienda Hotel and Casino, which was, of course, a Lefty Rosenthal-controlled hotel and casino because it was owned by Alan Glick as part of his four-casino package that the Teamsters helped him buy. The Upper Crust and My Place Lounge had become a focal point for the FBI and the Metro Intelligence to watch Spilotro and his henchmen. It's kind of like the Villa Capri in Kansas City here. That was like you knew that they would be there in the evening, so you would go watch and see who came and went and write down license plates. The Virginia Tavern for the Spiro part of the local crime scene.
Here in Kansas City,
and you sit and watch, and you just drive by and see who's there and write down some license plate numbers, come back by, maybe just sit there for a while and see who comes and goes. Well, in 1976, the FBI had created a special surveillance team, and they brought an agent, Emmett Michaels, from New York to work exclusively on Tony Spilotro and his crew.
The Bureau recruited myself, and I was working organized crime in New York. And they wanted to know if I wanted to come out here and work on this case, and I jumped at the opportunity. Myself and like 12 guys came out here, and then there was additional guys that came later. The operation as far as Tony Spilotro, and it wasn't Strawman at that time. It got a name. We all come out here, and for the first year, we basically were doing groundwork.
Well, now this new surveillance team and the Las Vegas Metro Intelligence were conducting moving surveillances and audio surveillances on the Spilotro crew, and they had the camera and the hidden microphone, and they were on telephones. They were all over these guys as much as they could, and Spilotro was really, really careful. Now, on the evening of June the 9th, 1980, two of Kent Clifford's intelligence unit members, Detective Dave Gruber and Sergeant Gene Smith, were conducting another, what was they thought was just a routine surveillance of the Spilotro gang around the Upper Crust Pizza Parlor and My Place Bar. And that was at, actually, that Maryland Parkway address is right at Flamingo Road and Maryland Parkway. I think it's pretty close to the Strip. They were just camped out there. I did that many times myself. You just get a spot a block or so away, and if you'd see somebody pull up that you wanted to see who they were that wasn't a normal person, you'd pull up closer and maybe pick up their tag and try to get a quick visual of their face, see if you could identify them.
And see what car they get into.
See what check out their car. Frank was, he cautioned these guys about this kind of stuff.
He wasn't in town probably at that time, maybe, not too long, maybe a month. And he still got these Illinois plates in the car, and he gets out of the car, and we say hello to him, you know, and I look at him. I say, Frankie, what the fuck? You're still riding around with Illinois plates. You got to take them plates off the car. And he says, yeah, I haven't had time. I said, well, if I were you, I'd get rid of them. You're driving a big Lincoln around. These cops, anybody that drives a car like yours is, in their eyes, especially from Illinois, is a gangster.
Yeah, a late model Lincoln Continental, that was a gangster car back in the late 70s, early 80s. I don't know what they're driving now.
Frankie Blue was a gangster.
Well, he was kind of. He was, but you know, he really wasn't. He worked as a maitre d'. His dad was in the Culinary Workers Union and was connected to the outfit. He probably wasn't. You know, one of those detectives, Detective Groover, would later remember, we put in a lot of long, tedious hours watching those guys. In that kind of work, things can change very quickly, and that night they did. And I remember I put in a lot of long, tedious hours, and only a couple of times they changed quickly, and luckily nothing really happened. You know, I had that one deal where we had Tuffy DeLuna and Joe Ragusa and Charlie Mortina and I think maybe Vince Abbott all came up trying. They were getting ready to do a hit, and then they saw us. And they started following me, and then when they got up next to me, they realized for sure I was a cop, and they got on out of there before I could get any help around, and I kind of like got boxed out at a stoplight, and they went left, and I had to go straight. Frank warned that guy's going to attract the attention of the Las Vegas Metro Intelligence Unit driving that car, Aaron, and, you know.
Or the Illinois plates.
Yeah, the Illinois plates for sure. And the guy just laughed and said, you know, well, somebody, that might be good if the cops are following me around. And he thought somebody had been following him, trying to set him up for a robbery. And he volunteered to these guys. Frank would say later that he volunteered that he wasn't afraid of these guys trying to rob him because he had a gun. And then the guy got his pizza and left after kind of shooting the breeze with him, sitting around on the table out front. Now, listen to what Larry Newman might have said about this killing.
We was just sitting around the Upper Crust out in front, and Frankie Blue came in for a pie. He was bitching that some guys were following him, trying to rob him. Frankie told him they were probably cops. But Frankie Blue was new out here, and he didn't get it. These fucking Vegas cops ain't like Chicago cops. They're cowboys. As he left with his pie, he told us he had a gun he got from his brother, and he was going to kill these fucking guys trying to rob him. The next thing we hear is the cops kill Frankie Blue. What are you going to do? They're the cops. He should have listened.
With the guys that were following him that were going to allegedly rob him, maybe they were the cops. It sounds like they probably were. And then when they maybe pulled him over, when they came to an altercation, he pulls out his gun. And what's a cop to do?
Yeah, that's true. What are you going to do? Guy comes out with a gun.
You're calling me a cowboy?
You start blasting away. You know what? And what they said later is what all they wanted to do was get him identified. They followed him away. And when the guy saw somebody was following him, realized this car was following him away from the Upper Crust, he started driving a real high rate of speed and swerving in and out of traffic. The officers threw their Kojak light on their dash and pulled up next to the Lincoln and you know, said, hey, pull over. And all of a sudden the Lincoln pulled over and the driver jumped out. Both the officers jumped out, pulled their guns, and Gene Smith, the sergeant, saw a gun in the driver's hand and fired immediately. And as I said, Frank Sculotta will say later that he said that he thought somebody was out to rob him and he was carrying a gun. And they did a background check on that gun and they traced it to a relative of the Bluestein kid. So I think there's no doubt that he had the gun.
Did they actually call it the Kojak light?
That's what we always called it. It was a Kojak light. That's like a light. Back when you used to
just put it on the dash.
Yeah, metal dashes, and it had
a magnetic thing.
Magnets on it, and you just plug it into the cigarette lighter and throw it up on the dash, and it's your Kojak light. Have you ever heard of a Kojak? Or you could throw it up on the, some people throw them up on the roof.
Well, is that actually because it was, you know, from the TV series
Kojak? Yeah, that's what Kojak used to do. He used to pull out his red light and throw it up on the roof and take off to do whatever he had to do. You never heard that term before, Kojak light? I guess most people haven't.
I thought that maybe that was like a technical term that they used in the police, you know, department.
I don't know. That's what we called it. Maybe somebody else calls it something else. I don't know. So the fallout from this was tremendous. Of course, there was a, you know, big hoopla, and they were Bluestein's father was going to sue the Las Vegas Metro Police Department, and Oscar Goodman jumped all over it. And I think they actually did file a lawsuit. I don't know the outcome of it. But Tony Spilotro was so mad, he asked Frank Collada to hire a couple of black guys to do something about it.
You know, these black guys you got, he said, well, they do anything you tell them to do. And I said, well, what would you want me to do? He said, well, I'm not quite sure yet. But my plan is we could cause this race riot. We'll have your guys come out, whack one of these cops, Groover or Smith, let it be seen that they're black. They'll shoot back to the north side. We'll take them and get them out of town. Now all these cops will think that the blacks did this, and then they'll just go around shooting every fucking black they see in town. He said, what do you think? I said, well, it's a good idea, and I'm sure these black guys will do it. I said, let me know when you're ready, and we'll take care of it. I don't know for sure, but we sort of believe that some of these officers rode by Tony's house and his brother Michael's, Johnny's house. They lived on the same street at different ends of the cul-de-sac and shot at their houses. And now Tony was super fucking mad. And he was really about ready to do this. And I guess, I don't know who it was, but somebody changed his mind or talked him out of it.
So things were pretty tense out there between the police and Tony Spilotro and his little hole-in-the-wall gang. Now, you remember our intrepid commander of the intelligence unit who cleaned it all up, Kent Clifford. He learned that Spilotro wanted to put a hit out on his two guys. During this time, somebody actually fired a shotgun into the side of one of the cops' homes also. And as Frank just said, somebody else fired a shotgun into Tony Spilotro's home and his brother's home, too, I guess. Commander Clifford, Kent Clifford, took some pretty drastic action to stop the escalation of these hostilities. He got on the airplane. I think he went to his sheriff, and the sheriff probably didn't believe he'd really do it, but he flew to Chicago, and he went to the homes of several outfit bosses up on the north side. They live up in these kind of north suburban areas just outside of the city limits of Chicago. And, of course, he found only maids or maybe a wife at home. He then went to the office of Alan Dorfman, and he told Alan Dorfman the addresses that he had just visited. And then he told Dorfman if anything ever happened to his officers, he would return with several men and kill everybody around these addresses. He claims later on that he received a phone call that afternoon when he was back in his hotel room advising him that the hit had been called off.
We had shot the Bluestein kid, or two of my men had shot the Bluestein kid. Why? There was a contract put out, and a mob member came in through Denver, bought a gun in Denver, and came to Las Vegas. We happened to have an informant in the room when he reported in. Tensions were high, so that's when I left and went to Chicago and talked to him. Well, I went to five of the mob bosses' homes and knocked on the door early in the morning. And after the first one, none of them was home. So I left messages, and then I went to Dorfman's office, who was the insurance guy that I knew was connected. So I told him what I was going to tell them. Tell them if they kill my men, I was going to come out to Chicago with 40 men and was going to kill everything that moved, walked, or crawled around these five houses.
So you can imagine what those mob guys were saying to each other after Kent Clifford did this.
That was actually Kent Clifford talking.
That was him talking, yeah.
And Kent...
He's deceased now, but I was able to get him interviewed for my movie Gangland Wire. He was serious. That was a serious guy. He was just what you think he would be. He was dead serious. He didn't laugh. He never smiled. He just said all this stuff. Matter of fact, this, that, and more. He was quite a guy. And he was incorruptible. I truly believe that he did clean up that intelligence unit and would not have taken a bribe, would not have even taken a free lunch from one of those casinos. I can't even imagine what Iupa and the rest of the bosses were wondering.
Did you have to pay him for the interview when you went out to Vegas?
No. He was a good guy. He got in the real estate business, commercial real estate business, after he left the police department, and he offered to get me an empty office to do my interviews in. We ended up just renting a hotel suite, like we did when we went out to Vegas and interviewed those guys at the Mob World Summit. My son and myself, he was our grip and our camera guy, Tony Laddish, our camera guy, and we all stayed out there in the rooms, and then had a central room where we could do these, and we just did interview after interview all day long for 2 days in a row.
And so if actually folks go out and rent or buy Gangland Wire, the documentary on Amazon, you can see more interviews with Kent Clifford.
Yeah, with Kent Clifford, and got a bunch of other guys, too, that aren't even in this podcast we're doing. So I can't even imagine what Iupa and Anthony Accardo and Jackie Cerrone and all those guys were talking about, or what they were thinking or saying. I know they were wondering, what the hell is Tony Spilotro doing out there in Las Vegas to draw this kind of heat back to Chicago? Many folks like to believe he was killed. Spilotro was eventually killed because of an supposed affair with Lefty's wife, Jerry. But more so than having an affair with some other mob associate's wife, this is the kind of stuff that'll get you killed. That and stealing money. You know, the things that'll get you killed is bringing unnecessary heat, snitching, or stealing money from the bosses, and not necessarily in that order. Probably stealing money from the bosses will get you killed quicker than anything. But bringing unnecessary heat will certainly put you in a lot of trouble, and this was a lot of really unnecessary heat. What do you think the worst violation for a mob guy would be? Bringing unnecessary heat, informing, or stealing money? Or having an affair with another mob guy's wife?
All of the above.
All of the above.
All of the above. I think are all in the candidacy for getting killed. But I certainly, you know, you have to look at it this way, too. Here's this guy, you know, who comes out, Kent Clifford flying out to Chicago, knocking on the boss's doors over a guy whose dad's kind of, I mean, this guy's like just a junior associate. He's
right.
Really nobody. He's not even a made man. And, you know, sure, he gets killed. And that's a bad thing. But, you know, I'd be pissed about that. This guy's nobody. What are these guys coming around knocking on our doors telling if you whack this guy or any of these cops that they're going to come and kill us?
Yeah, I can imagine somebody in Chicago.
And I hear you're sleeping with somebody's wife.
Got on the phone and got the message to Spilotro pretty quick that, you know, knock this shit off. Because if you think about it, really it was almost like a traffic accident in a way. When you live that life, and you're hanging out in those areas, and not those areas maybe, but you're hanging out with those kinds of people, and you don't know how to deal with intelligence police or FBI agents in a logical, rational manner, then, you know, you kind of got it coming, if you ask me.
Well, maybe if you're in the business of robbing drug dealers and other criminals, you would think, if someone's following me around, maybe they're just trying to rob me.
Yeah, well, that's what he thought.
And the officers weren't in uniform.
No, they weren't.
So nothing happens to them, though, right?
The officers, no. It was real justified because the guy did have a gun. If they couldn't have found that gun, they would have been in the wind probably for a while. They'd have been left to twist slowly in the wind. More than likely, they would have gotten fired, maybe, or at least the guy who did the shooting would have gotten fired if they hadn't found a gun. But, of course, back in those days, and I don't know, they probably don't do it anymore today with all these cameras around, you usually got something around you can throw down, say he had at least a bright, shiny object. So you thought it was a gun.
Well,
you always got to cover yourself in these deals, Aaron.
So I'm just kind of curious, in the instance, you know, where I was robbed, and the guy didn't actually produce a gun, but he had something in his hand, yeah, in his pocket. And it kind of, as I'm looking over, it's kind of like there was a light reflecting off of it. It could have been a gun. It could have been something else.
Could have been a cell phone. Could have been a pack of cigarettes. Could have been anything. But he was bought and paid for if you wanted to shoot him. And he hadn't had a gun. The facts of that circumstance were he's bought and paid for. No, he was blue.
Frankie Blue wasn't black. I mean, he was an African-American, so no. I'm kind of confused on this idea that they're going to have these black guys kill the cops and start a race war.
Well, that was Spilotro's idea, to do something, take some action against the police, but not have it come back to them.
Yeah.
He wanted to have it come back to some kind of a race war.
Do you know what ever happened to Sergeant Gene Smith or Detective David Grover?
You know, I tried to get hold of them. I put some messages out, but I could not get hold of them. I found an interview of them, got a couple, three quotes from them, but I couldn't find that. And that was an interview from way back then from the newspaper. So I are right after, but I couldn't get a hold of them. I couldn't figure out where they were, so I didn't have time to keep looking for them. So next week, we're going to deal with the night of the burglary at Bertha's. Here, this gang has been doing good scores. They feel really safe at their joint, the Upper Crust. They're getting comped at the Stardust. They've got connections all over Vegas. Ernie DeVino's got loan shark money out. And as he said, people were throwing money at him after they found out he was with Tony Spilotro. They're the only mob in Las Vegas. Now, what can go wrong?
So when they went to Bertha's that night for this $1 million score, they walked into an ambush. It was joint operation by the feds and also the Las Vegas Metro.
Which is just hilarious because, you know, they thought it was $1 million score, and it was for the feds.
For the feds and Metro Police.
Because they swept up all of these criminals.
You know, that Gene Smith and Dave Gruber and Kent Clifford and that Emmett Michaels, those guys are running around high-fiving each other all night. And I know that feeling. I've been there. Finally, one time after all those years, you catch them really dirty on the inside.
Get them all sitting down there and get that photograph of them all together. Yeah. And sending that to the newspaper.
Oh, there's no better feeling than catching them on the inside, Aaron. I'll tell you what, one time we caught some guys, they did a burglary. And they stashed, it was a house burglar, and they stashed the property behind the garage and left the area. So we set up a stakeout. I was in the TAC unit at the time. I wasn't in intelligence. It was out on patrol, and we went down to the garage and borrowed a van and got a couple of slick cars and set up all around it. I got on a roof where I could see right down into the middle of it. And we had a couple of guys get in this garage, this old garage that was about 10 yards from where this TV and computer and some stuff like that were piled up against the back of this house. And pretty soon this car comes smelling around, and they drive slow, and they slow way down. Then they speed up, and they go away, and then they come back, and they slow way down. And then they pulled around to the side of the house to there's an open lot, and somebody gets out, and, you know, we're radioing each other by then. Okay, they're out. And then about that time, the guy out of the garage, had a great big guys in the garage, and I'm looking down through this kind of between some houses, and I can see this big dude that worked for me, Steve Miller, come out of that garage, burst out of it, grabbed this kid, and he bounced him off the wall of the house that they piled that stuff up against. But, and the van, there's another driver, and the guys in the van were over by it, and they come flying in and block off the other car and jump out, and they're screaming at this guy and pulling him out of the car and throwing him down. It was great. I mean, it's better than sex sometimes to do something like that. I have this indelible memory imprinted on my mind of Steve bouncing. He just hit that wall and literally bounced back off of it.
They didn't act like they didn't know what they were doing. They just were driving around, and they didn't realize there was stolen stuff right by the garage.
Well, I guess. I'm not sure. They didn't really do much talking after that. They just went down, and we booked them, and detectives dealt with them the next day. So if you have a friend or relative who has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire. Not only going to hear Kent Clifford, but you're going to hear more great true crime associates, members of the mob, talking from the wiretaps, talking about the skim in Vegas. Gangland Wire, available on Amazon to rent or to buy. And then after you're done watching that, you're going to want to know more, and you're going to want to get Gary's latest book, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
And that's so great as a read, but it's an even better listen. That's right, I just said it's a listen. Get the Kindle version, and there's hyperlinks to video files with audio, with transcriptions, with the actual words from the mouth of the men that did it. And it's so interesting, and there's so much history there, that then you're going to want to get Gary's app, The Kansas City Mob Tour. For $1.99, you can take your own personalized turn-by-turn tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And don't forget to put a hit out on our donate button. Help us with these episodes. Share, subscribe, support, give us a review. Better yet, wet our beak by subscribing. And we have a PayPal account where you can just get a monthly subscription now. Become one of our mob associates.
Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Bumper music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.